Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently working on a book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nina Kosheva.
Thank you.
And your grandfather, the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev, gave Crimea to Ukraine in 1954. So I guess it's all your grandfather's fault.
I guess it is. That's what I've been hearing. Not really, although. In 1954, it was the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation, Ukrainian Republic within the Soviet Union were are parts of the same larger territory, so it was more a matter of topography than anything else. And of course, that it became a political issue only in 1991 when Ukraine became independent and Russia also became its own country when the Soviet Union collapsed. So I think if we are looking for anybody's fault, let's just blame Boris Yeltsin, who did not claim back Crimea from Ukraine in 91.
And in 1994, of course, there was the Budapest Agreement where the UK, the US, Russia, and Ukraine signed an agreement ratifying the status quo in order to get the nuclear weapons out. And, of course, this meant and I think the agreement also meant to respect Ukraine's territorial integrity, which is certainly not what's happening now.
Well, it certainly is not what's happening now, and it has been very strong calls, which so far has not been entirely rejected by Sergei Lavrov, Russian foreign minister, which gives me a bit of hope that some resolution could be made to the crisis. The calls to actually meet between the signatories of the Budapest Agreement and, in fact, come up with some sort of solution, consensus, and try to stabilize the situation. Although I have to say, I really don't hold much hope, or any hope at all, for that matter, that Vladimir Putin will take his boots out of Crimea, even if legalistically Crimea may find some sort of status that will satisfy the Ukrainians or the signatories of the Budapest Agreement.
And do you think that Putin did this on his own or did it at the behest of the generals?
I think he did it on his own. I mean, he was completely, as Stalin one time put it in an article when industrialization was going really well, collectivization was going well, he trying to blame somebody else. He wrote an article which is called Lightheaded from Success. I think Sochi gave Putin a bit of a lightheadedness. He was so drunk on his own power that that Sochi would be, so that was soft power, but now the hard power image that he wants to preserve and portray was that maraschino cherry on top of an ice cream Sochi sundae. So I think it was his own decision. I don't think he was too much influenced by generals or anyone else, but also I think he wants to make sure that whatever happened in Kiev with his protege Viktor Yanukovych, the president who fled and now ousted, is not going to happen to him. And I think there's various incentives for Crimea to become a role model of how not to anger Putin. Of course, their national interests, like the Black Sea Fleet, but all these things really come into account.
Well, I read this article that you recommended, Nina, Why There Will Be War in Ukraine, in the Moscow Times by Sergei Markov, and it's replete with all of the state propaganda that I imagine Russians, since there's no diversity in the media anymore, except for Novaya Gazeta, everything else has been closed down. People believe that this is a putsch by neo-Nazis and anti-Semites in Kyiv, even though Ukraine's new prime minister, Yatsenyuk, is Jewish, and he's coming to the White House on Wednesday. I'm just quoting from the article. If the junta leaders want to avoid war, they need to adopt Moscow's peaceful and democratic proposals and adhere to them. That's certainly not going to happen, is it?
Well, it is. I mean, it's a remarkable piece of propaganda. And you know, as for Yatsenyuk, by the way, he's absolutely not a fringe element in any way. He was second in command of Yulia Tymoshenko, who was prime minister for quite some time in Ukraine before Yanukovych came in 2010, and in fact actually had rather good relationship with Vladimir Putin. So that is all, I mean, certainly very propagandistically slanted, but no, not really. I mean, it is very Soviet-like propaganda, but in Moscow, for example, nobody buys that kind of argument because people are perfectly capable of making their own decisions. But it is, I mean, all these lines that they're put forward by Sergei Markov, by outlets like Russia Today, the TV English language channel, these are all then to, if Putin decides to go further, for example, that he feels that he hasn't proven his masculinity enough, that he's the Putin of all the Russias, then they will have language that Markov put forward and you know, Sergei Lavrov, the minister, put forward that they can base their actions upon. So they can tell you, we told you so, we warned you. And none of it, of course, has to do with democracy, but just displaying Russian power or preserve Putin's power for that matter.
But it would seem to me that if you have a choice between a European model of governance with transparency and not having to pay bribes to everybody compared to what Putin is offering with Yanukovych, this crook that stole the country blind, and now in Ukraine he's putting forth the new prime minister Aksionov is a former minor gangster called the Goblin, Konstantinov, the Speaker of the Crimean Parliament, is a scam artist who fleeced a bunch of people into putting up money for apartment buildings that were never built. These are not very savory people. At the end of the day, how long is that model of corruption sustainable?
Well, I don't think this model is sustainable altogether, but such is the reality of our part of the world, is that competition, ultimately, freedom of choice, somehow seem to be much harder choices than when you're told what to do, how to do it. You make yourself rich today and don't think about the future because, in fact, you know, the history of our, once again, part of the world does show that you don't know what's going to happen to you tomorrow, so you might as well steal everything today. So this is really it's not even so much a battle of Ukraine, Russia, West Russia, but it's also a very painful process of changing one's mind, of really changing mental model. I mean, that book that I wrote, The Gulag of the Russian Mind, is exactly on that very subject, is how the mind needs to be changed from this sort of circular, self-repeating prophecies of Russian corruption, Russian destruction, Russian revolution, Russian despotism, and I include Ukraine and, you know, sort of other states that are part of the same or at least were forced to be part of the same mindset, versus the much more linear and open and transparent mind that democracy seems to offer. Not perfectly, but at least much better version.
And again, I'm speaking with Nina Kosheva, who's a professor in the graduate program of international affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics, and the new book, The Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. So with Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague warning Russia has made a big miscalculation in entering Crimea, you know, if this blows up in Putin's face, and my understanding is that the Russian people are dead against the idea of spilling Ukrainian blood, one of the things that I think might be worth thinking about here is that couldn't there be something worse than Putin if he falls? I mean, in other words, do you think there's a possibility?
Right.
Is there a possibility that you'd ever have a liberal alternative? It seems, based upon what I can see, the liberals are very weak.
Well, I mean, look, there's always a chance that you're not going to get something perfect, and you shouldn't. But the whole point of something that you brought up earlier very, very, very appropriately is that sort of transparency, democracy, these wonderful things, is that that's why we have elections. I mean, some people are worse, some people are better. Talent grows while not a great president is sitting in and only there for four years. And this is something that Russia doesn't have. And I think Russia really should take that chance and should take that opportunity to develop this kind of talent. How can you develop talent when Putin is sitting there for almost 15 years now? So maybe it would be something worse, but then it would be up to us to change that in 4 years. And that's what I think we should really, we should absolutely aspire to. I mean, yes, the liberals are weak, but so where are non-liberals either? I mean, we don't really have any strong, right-wing candidates as well. So why don't we just, you know, Putin falls, why don't we have elections and see what happens?
Well, there's no question that he has been in power, is in power, and as you've mentioned, it does seem that power has gone to his head, he's surrounded by in a city where most of the educated elite in Russia don't like him, right? Does he feel uncomfortable, you think?
Well, power went into his head. He's very, I think, like all autocrats, he is monumentally surprised when he feels that we don't like him, and he feels that, you know, I took you in 2000 when you were completely distorted by Yeltsin's own corruption and disarray and this Wild West capitalism, and I gave you, you know, travel permissions, and you're rich because he took advantage of the high world oil prices. And here you are, ungrateful brats. That's how he, I'm sure, feels about us, the Moscovites and population in big cities all together. But at the same time, what he's doing in Ukraine, and what, you know, that Markov's article, I'm so happy we're giving him that promotion, Markov's article suggested it's also incredible fear that on one hand he does feel like a typical Russian autocrat, on the other hand he's terrified that something that happened in Kiev may happen to him, and he's taking all precaution, all this humanitarian nonsense that they're talking about, that, you know, they need to protect the Russian population that has not been abused so far in Ukraine in any way. It's all preventive measures for their own safety, not so much for the Ukrainian-Russian population safety at all.
Well, Nina Khrushcheva, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nina Khrushcheva, who's a professor in the Graduate Program of International Affairs at the New School and a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. She's also an editor of and a contributor to Project Syndicate and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of Imagining Nabokov, Russia Between Art and Politics. She's currently finishing the Lost Khrushchev, A Family Journey into the Gulag of the Russian Mind. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Mike Lofgren about his new essay, Anatomy of the Deep State.